Hello and welcome to this British Journal of Surgery podcast. I'm Wendy Barnaby and this is a podcast with a difference. It's for members of the RULO Club of Trainee Vascular Surgeons. We're having a conference call with three of them dotted round the country. They are Mr. Simon Hobbs at New Cross Hospital, Wolverhampton, Mr. Femi Oshin from the Royal Liverpool Hospital and Mr. Robert Hinchcliffe of St. George's Vascular Institute in London. They've chosen some BJS papers that they think would be of particular interest to their fellow trainees. Each of them has picked out two papers that they'd like to recommend. So first of all, let's hear from Mr. Simon Hobbs at New Cross Hospital in Wolverhampton. Simon, what's your first choice?
Well, the first paper we got is a case-controlled comparison of profundoplasty and femoropopliteal supragenicular bypass for peripheral arterial disease. And it's by Koscielny et al. From Bonn University Medical School.
We're looking in this paper at the sort of situation that smokers can find themselves in with hardening of the arteries when the superficial femoral artery is blocked and surgeons have to restore circulation. And so they have two different options. They can operate on the profunda femoral artery to reconstruct it, do a profundoplasty, which is a short operation, or they can bypass the occluded segment of the superficial femoral artery. In other words, do a femoro to above the knee popliteal surgery. And that's the treatment of choice, isn't it? But it's longer and riskier than the profundoplasty. So do you think profundoplasty has a role in 2010?
Yes, I think it does have a role, but I think it's difficult to define. And this study may not be sort of have all the answers. Profundoplasty can be used on its own, or certainly in my clinical practice, more often in conjunction with other techniques, such as inflow procedures, femoral endarterectomies, or with the distal bypasses. Certainly as a sole treatment, it may well have a role in subjects who are perhaps not suitable for, as you said, the gold standard bypass, perhaps those without a decent vein, and perhaps even those who are unfit or need a simple procedure under local anaesthetic, for example.
So you wouldn't think it's a question of either or as this study sets it up?
I don't think so. And I mean, certainly in my practice, I would tend to use both of them in conjunction. And I suppose that's one area that this study doesn't help to clarify.
It sounds as though it doesn't actually help to define the role of these different procedures by themselves.
No, I guess there are a number of issues with this study. It's not a randomised control study, which are, I suppose, recognised as the better quality studies. It is a retrospective case control, which has some merits, but also does introduce a number of biases. And it's also not entirely clear of the exact inclusion criteria used to define which patients got which treatment. Certainly, I would like to see as well evidence that, you know, sort of looking at both the treatments in combination, and I mean, this paper suggests that both treatments have some efficacy, but does combining both treatments significantly improve that efficacy?
Well, tell us about your second paper.
The second paper is, this time is a randomised control trial, and it's a randomised clinical trial of distal anastomotic interposition vein cuff in infrainguinal polytetrafluoroethylene bypass grafting. And it's by Griffiths et al. On behalf of the Joint Vascular Research Group.
Right. Now, this is about a decision that arises in bypass surgery above or below the knee when the surgeon is using a prosthetic bypass graft. And the question is whether to use a Miller cuff, a 2 to 3 millimeter length of vein material, where the bypass graft joins the artery again. Why do you think one might use a prosthetic lower limb bypass?
Well, prosthetic bypasses are used for many reasons, and generally when there is not adequate vein to use for a conventional bypass, as it were, with vein. In my opinion, prosthetic bypasses should be reserved solely for limb salvage procedures in subjects who do not have sufficient autologous vein in the leg or in the arm, and perhaps where no other treatment options, for example, angioplasty, are available.
So really when you're in a pretty extreme situation?
I think so, yes, although there are other groups who would be more sort of free in their use of prosthetic material.
Do you think it should be routine to use the cuff at the join between the prosthetic graft and the artery?
I think on the basis of this paper, it would appear that cuffing should not necessarily be routine for prosthetic bypasses to the above knee popliteal artery, but perhaps should be routine for bypasses going below the knee joint to the below knee popliteal artery. I guess a caveat to this statement is that although cuffing appears to significantly improve patency rates of below knee grafts, this did not necessarily translate into improved limb salvage rates. This might simply be a reflection of the reasonably small numbers of patients in the study, but I think should be borne in mind. Furthermore, the study only assessed PTFE grafts, and whilst the result probably would be transferable to other prosthetic materials, this has not necessarily been investigated in this study.
How do you think we can minimise the number of prosthetic bypasses that are done?
I think probably the most important factor is to perform these procedures in specialist centres with surgeons who have a specific interest in these forms of bypasses. I think these surgeons will probably be probably take a more aggressive policy of using vein wherever possible and reserving prosthetic material for those cases where that is not possible. I think there's a strong argument for good preoperative assessment of patients in terms of vein mapping to try and find the most suitable vein in the preoperative period. And the final thing is I think there will be an increasing role for endovascular treatment, i.e. doing angioplasties rather than perhaps traditional surgery, which may well minimise or reduce the need for doing open surgical procedures.
Fermi, your papers are about varicose veins. What's the first one?
The first one that I'm going to talk about is a randomised clinical trial of radiofrequency ablation or conventional high ligation and stripping of the great saphenous varicose veins. And this is a paper by Subramania et al. And Mr. Tim Lees. And it comes from King's Mill Hospital and Northern Vascular Centre in Newcastle.
This is about the best way to treat varicose veins, isn't it? Whether it's better to use conventional surgery or radiofrequency ablation, that technique that uses electrodes to generate heat which closes the vein. First of all, what are the indications for treating varicose veins? When do they need treatment?
Varicose veins are largely benign disease. However, they can eventually lead to discoloration and thickening of the skin, a condition called lipodermatosclerosis. Ultimately, may result in ulcers. These veins may also be subject to clots as well, which can result in phlebitis or inflammation of the veins. And it is really that spectrum of the last three things that I talked about, due to the ulcers, the skin changes, and also the thrombophlebitis that triggers treatment. But as is well known, the majority of veins are treated for cosmetic reasons, really.
And I gather there are some problems with conventional surgery. What are they?
Well, you've got to remember that conventional surgery is an invasive procedure, and when we talk about conventional surgery, we're usually talking about the ligation and stripping of the great saphenous vein. In order to achieve this, one needs to perform an incision in the groin in order to disconnect the superficial vein from the deep venous system, and then physically remove the great saphenous vein by stripping it out. So this is in itself a fairly brutal procedure, which can result in some bleeding, and like all surgical procedures, is also prone to wound infections following the initial procedure. Another problem with stripping of the great saphenous vein is the fact that you have some cutaneous nerves which run in close proximity to the vein, and these may be damaged during the procedure and lead to altered sensation or a complete loss of sensation in the worst case scenario.
So do you think that radio frequency ablation is the answer?
I think radiofrequency ablation, certainly from this trial and other trials, has demonstrated that these potential outcomes which are related to open surgery may be avoided. There's certainly a reduced incidence of wound infection, and this trial has demonstrated, like others, that people return to work quicker, possibly because they do not have to deal with the same level of post-operative pain. However, like all types of endovascular procedures, the main limitation is patient anatomy. And in this sort of procedure, one needs a fairly straight great saphenous vein in order to treat the patient. However, that is not always the case, and I think that there still will be a place for open surgery in some instances.
So it sounds as though radiofrequency ablation could be a good technique in many cases, but not all.
No, certainly not all. The other alternative, perhaps, is another form of venous ablation, which uses chemical therapy and using a sclerosant in such cases. So the endovenous treatment is always a possibility, but there is limited experience with using foam sclerotherapy for the great saphenous vein. It's not something that some people are comfortable doing.
Now, Femi, what's your second choice? This is also about varicose vein surgery.
Yes, my second choice is a randomised clinical trial of co-amoxiclav versus no antibiotic prophylaxis in varicose vein surgery. And this is a paper by Makako and et al. From Hull.
And this is about whether it's a good idea to give antibiotics prophylactically for varicose vein surgery or not, the idea being to reduce the rate of groin wound complications following the surgery.
That's correct.
What are the main results of this trial then?
Well, I mean, this trial essentially demonstrates that in patients in whom prophylactic antibiotics were given preoperatively, the incidence of wound infection, as determined by a validated asepsis wound score, was lower. And there was also an association between increasing body mass index and concurrent smoking with poorer wound outcomes after the initial procedure.
Is it a particularly well-designed study?
I think it was a very well-designed study. I mean, its plus points are that it is a randomised controlled trial. The primary outcome measure was clear. And also the way in which the primary outcome measure was determined, as in using a validated scoring method.
Were there any confounding factors?
Well, I think the main confounding factor was that whilst the study was well designed, the outcome measures were determined by the patients themselves, in that determining whether or not a wound appeared to be infected was determined by each patient having a diary in which they recorded the appearances of the wound, and using the patient's own observations, a score was given to each wound. And the problem with that is that even amongst trained individuals, there's a degree of subjectivity looking at wounds. But this is much less with medically trained personnel. And so the validity of the differences between the two groups may be called into question, particularly as 14 days afterwards, when everybody was reviewed by somebody who was medically trained, there were no statistically significant differences between the two groups.
Still, I mean, the results saying that the antibiotics should be given routinely, especially if patients are obese or are current smokers, it sounds reasonably convincing, doesn't it? Would you use prophylaxis routinely then in future on the basis of this?
I think the main thrust of this paper was to determine whether or not prophylactic antibiotics should be used in clean surgery, where the incidence of wound infection is very low to begin with. Certainly what they have demonstrated is that it is associated with smoking and increased body mass index. And one would perhaps have to think that an increase in body mass index equates to a patient where the operation itself is difficult. And as such, I think more attention to surgical technique is warranted. But in terms of my own personal practice, I think I'd probably tend to be more selective rather than routinely use it. I don't think this paper has provided enough evidence to suggest routine use of prophylactic antibiotics in the treatment of varicose veins.
Now let's turn to Mr. Rob Hinchliff of St. George's Vascular Institute in London. Rob, your two choices are about surgery for repairing aortic aneurysms. Which paper are you going to talk about first?
We'll talk about the Thompson paper, which is the growth rates of small abdominal aortic aneurysms correlate with clinical events.
Here the authors were analysing data from screening abdominal aortic aneurysms to see if they could find any factors that would predict when surgery would be needed or even when the aneurysm might rupture. So what does this study tell us that we didn't know before about the growth of abdominal aortic aneurysms?
I think this is very important and an interesting study from the Chichester group, who have a wealth of experience in abdominal aortic aneurysm screening. And prior to this study, we generally believe that the natural history of abdominal aortic aneurysms was to dilate and rupture unless the patient died of another cause. However, this study really showed us that perhaps that wasn't the case, and that there may be sort of two groups of patients, one group who continue to expand and dilate and require surgery or rupture, and another group who really wouldn't do that. And that really sort of changed the way that we think about these problems.
So what implications does it have for screening?
I think the main implication is that we may well be able to identify cohorts of patients who really don't require such intensive screening, and other cohorts of patients who may well require more intense screening to prevent their aneurysm rupturing. So patients who have abdominal aortic aneurysm growth of 2 millimetres per year, we may well put into a more intense schedule, whereas those patients who have a aneurysm which grows much less than that, less than 2 millimetres per year, really perhaps may not actually require such intense surveillance and may actually not require any further screening after the first couple of scans.
And do you think that's the most important thing to do in the future then, or does it have any other implications for what you should be doing?
Well, I think certainly these findings need to be confirmed in another study, and using the National Abdominal Aortic Aneurysm Screening Program to do some further research on the factors which may be associated with aneurysm growth and rupture would be very worthwhile. And then I certainly think it will probably result in a prospective randomised trial to try and identify and confirm those findings.
Now, what about your second paper, Rob? What's that?
That is by Black et al., and that's long-term surveillance with computed tomography after endovascular aneurysm repair may not be justified.
Right, so this is about the best aftercare for patients whose aortas have been repaired below the kidney. They've had a stent positioned in the effective part of the aorta, and specifically whether you need to do routine scans of the site of the operation afterwards to see whether it might need a bit more attention. I mean, what sort of attention might you have to give it? What are the long-term risks of endovascular stenting?
Well, certainly endovascular aneurysm repair has been heavily scrutinised because, especially with the first and probably the second generation of aortic stent grafts, there were a number of problems, including leaks around the stent, or what we call endoleaks. There were stent fractures, migration of the stent, and kinking of the iliac limbs. So those are the real long-term risks. And obviously, there have been a problem in the past with in the region of 40% at 5 years requiring re-interventions in the large EVAR trials.
So on the basis of this paper, do you think that we need routine scans to avoid that?
But I think there are several issues. I think the authors have used probably what's deemed to be one of the better stent grafts, which is second or third generation design. And what they found was that many of the interventions were required in the first 3 months, and it may be with better imaging within the first 3 months that a number of these issues may have been identified and prevented. And certainly what they also seemed to suggest was that routine surveillance of the aortic stent grafts didn't necessarily prevent complications or predict intervention. And actually only 6 out of the 31 people who had complications were detected by the surveillance imaging.
It doesn't sound a huge number, does it?
I think it's relatively interesting because in most units the number of scans and surveillance images required are take a heavy toll on the sort of resources that any unit has. And if we can actually identify those groups at high risk, then that would be ideal to reduce the amount of resources spent.
Yeah, so what do you think the ideal surveillance regimen would be?
Well, I think probably we should really be moving away from routine CT scanning. I think it's quite clear from the paper that the vast majority of complications appear early in the post-operative course. And we should probably be using a number of different modalities early on. And the group from St. George's have used 3D rotation angiography at the end of the procedure, which is very similar to CT scanning, and that has really reduced the number of secondary interventions and complications within the first month or so. And I think long-term CT surveillance probably now isn't warranted, and a lot of units have actually made the move over from routine CT surveillance to duplex ultrasound scanning, and some units use abdominal x-rays to identify stent fractures.
Well, thank you all very much indeed for that, and we hope that the Rouleau Club has enjoyed this rundown of useful papers. We hope you'll come back and listen to our future podcasts. Goodbye.